Back when I was in school, we had to learn poetry. That was one of the requirements, and it was not something I necessarily loved, but it wasn't something I hated either. And so we learned about all the different poets, especially English poets, and one of them was Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. You likely have heard of him. About 200 years ago, he wrote a poem entitled The Rainy Day. And you might think on just first noting that title, it's about a poet's thoughts on the weather. But really, it's more than that. It's about the struggles and the difficulties of life. The last stanza of the poem is the most famous one, and let me read it for you. It says, "Be still, sad heart, and cease repining. Behind the clouds is the sun still shining. Thy fate is the common fate of all. Into each life some rain must fall. Some days must be dark and dreary." I noted that that line, which eventually became a song much later, "Into each life must rain, some rain must fall." Now, sometimes life can seem like a lot of sunshine, and things are going quite well, and life's good. But I can guarantee you, just as Wadsworth's Longfellow said, "Into each life some rain must fall." Life, sooner or later, is going to present those rainy days. Life is hard, and anybody who says otherwise is naive. Trials and tribulations are unavoidable. And sometimes it feels like trials come at us like dodgeballs on a middle school recess. You know, you dodge one here, you dodge one there, but you can't help but being hit by trials. Reminded me of a story I heard of a sergeant in the U.S. Army who was stationed at a base in Germany. It was an airborne unit. And so they were practicing parachute jumps, but their landing site was right next door to a Mercedes-Benz test track. So one day, this particular sergeant was jumping from the plane and opened his parachute, and a gust of wind caught him and pulled him towards the racetrack. And he realized that if he landed on asphalt, it could be terrible for his legs. He could break his legs in that kind of a landing. So he braced himself as he came down towards the hard asphalt track. Thankfully, he landed without breaking any bones. About the time he finally caught his breath, a gust of wind again caught his parachute and dragged him along the track for a couple hundred yards. Eventually, he was able to cut the parachute loose, and he was able to breathe. And then he heard the noise of an incoming car. A car was racing around the track towards him. He scrambled and got off the track into the grass just in time, and the car missed him. And he thought to himself, "I am so lucky." And then he turned, and his foot fell into a gopher hole, and he twisted his ankle. True story. And that's how life sometimes feels. You know, one thing after another, but in the end, you still twist your ankle. And I think we all, even though we've probably never been in any of those circumstances, all can relate to that illustration. You know, one minute you're falling fast towards the ground, you're about to be hit by a car, and the next minute you've twisted your ankle in a gopher hole. You know, life is full of trials, some very big, some pretty small. But each one of them tests our faith. For example, some trials can be quite small, and yet they really do push our buttons. It's things like losing your car keys and spending half an hour looking for them, waking up with a splitting headache, going to the restaurant only to find out that your order is wrong the second time, stubbing your toe while walking around at night. That one really gets me. But then, of course, there are some trials that are a lot bigger, like when your water heater in your house explodes and fills the floor with water. Or the time you have a blowout in your tire on the interstate. Or finding out that the pain that you're experiencing is not just a passing feeling, it's a chronic condition you're going to have to live with for the rest of your life. Sometimes our trials are things like going to your bank and finding out all your money has been cleared out by a hacker. Or finding out that your job no longer needs you anymore. Or a tree falls on your house. And we could go on and on. We haven't even touched on the big disasters like receiving a terminal diagnosis or losing a loved one. The point is, life is filled with all kinds of different problems, aggravations, troubles, tragedies. And what they do is they bring out what is inside us already. So no matter how mature or how godly we may think we are, how we respond in those moments is really the proof. They reveal what is on the inside of us. So we note with James this morning that trials are good because they cause us to grow. The fact is, we need a little rain in our lives. There's an old proverb that says, sunshine makes deserts. And so it is. You think about what causes growth, what causes us to be healthy as believers, to grow in maturity. Well, we need trials to do that. They may not be pleasant, they may not be fun, but they are good for us. And don't you find it interesting that when you open the book of James, which is so filled with practical insight, the first thing he talks about is trials. I don't think that's a coincidence. I don't think that was just making a list and that was the first thing that came up. I think James is writing this to say, listen, if you want to show your faith, here's where you do it. If you want your faith to be demonstrated, it's going to be demonstrated in trials, perhaps more than any other moment of your life. Trials is where faith gets tested. And before we go any further here, perhaps I should try to define what I mean by trials. What is a trial anyways? Here's a definition that I came up with. A trial is any pressure or circumstance, internal or external, which tests our faith. So it's some aggravation, it's some problem, it's some issue that comes up, and it could be internal, it could be the kind of feelings that produce from inside, or it could just be something happens to you. But the end result is your faith gets tested. I feel a bit like our faith this week was tested in our house. I already mentioned that we've had sickness. We've also had an emergency room visit. We've also had a couple of nosebleeds this week. So it kind of has felt like one thing after another. But those moments and how you respond to them show what's underneath. So let's take a look at what James has to say. These are really some of the most famous words from the book of James. The first four verses, really 2 through 4. And when it comes to trials, James lays out, first of all, the requirement for us in trials. Then he explains the reason for the trials. And then finally, what results from the trials. So let's begin by looking at the requirement. What's the requirement that he gives? Well, the requirement is quite simply this: joy in trials. That's what is required of you and me, to have joy in trials. Listen to what he says, verse 2. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. So there it is, the requirement. Count trials and tribulations as joy. If you've been a Christian for any length of time, you probably have read this verse before, and you knew what was coming. But put yourselves in the shoes of James' first readers. James, a servant of God, of the Lord Jesus Christ, greetings. And then he says, count it all joy when you face trials. James, what planet are you living on here? What kind of instructions are these? Trials are not something that elicit joy. Quite the opposite. What is he talking about? Well, really, the first thing for us to note is trying to wrap our head around what James is thinking here. Is James simply saying that we need to just pretend that everything's fine, to kind of paste on a smile, and whenever trials come, just don't worry about it? The year I was born, there was a song that topped the charts in the U.S. for a couple of weeks, and it was the song by Bobby McFerrin, "Don't Worry, Be Happy." Here's one of the lines from the song. In every life, we have some trouble, but when you worry, you make it double. Don't worry, be happy. Is that what James is saying? Just don't worry, be happy. You're going to have trouble, but just put a smile on. Well, I think what James is getting at is a little bit deeper than that. And to really understand this, we need to take this first word, at least as it appears in my text. He says, count it all joy, count. Or maybe your version says, consider it all joy. That's really the crux of what he's going to say here, count. Now, the word count, or reckon, or consider, is a accounting term. Now, I'm not much of an accountant, but I do understand basically how things work, where in accounting you have, in the simplest form, you've got, expenses and you've got income. You've got, two lines, credit and debit. In the old days, you'd have a ledger book, and you'd have lines and everything. You'd fill in, you know, the credits and the debits, and you'd have to make everything match up. Every transaction goes in the book. Now, today, we have all kinds of computer software to automatically fill these things for us. But it's still essentially the same. Everything gets tracked. Every expense. And what I'm convinced is that all of us, in whether we think about it or not, whether we realize it or not, all of us have a ledger book somewhere in our lives, in our minds, where we catalog everything that happens to us. And basically, there's a good column and a bad column. And so whenever something happens, we kind of sort it into one of those. You know, hey, I found a dollar bill on the floor today. Put that in the good column. Or, hey, I shut my hand in the door today. Put that in the bad column. And so on and so forth. You know, everything we happens to us, we tend to think, oh, that was a good thing, that was a bad thing. Maybe we even have a neutral line in the middle somewhere, but the point is, we're thinking about these things in terms of good and bad. And so what James is saying is to count those things that are trials in the good column. Put them in the joy column of your ledger. Now, we automatically would take those trials and put them in the negative, right? We'd say, these are terrible things. These are things that I hate it. But James says, I want you to, and it's a mental activity. He's not saying, feel a certain way about trials. He's not saying, you know, enjoy your trials. James' instruction here is not so that we would go home and, you know, you wake up tomorrow and you're sick and you say, oh, I love being sick. Nobody says that. And that's not what James is saying. But he's saying we should reckon or consider the things that are bad as actually having a good purpose in our lives. So, surprise birthday with balloons and cake, you know, we put that in the good column. Flat tire, that goes in the bad column. Well, for James, he's saying consider these trials as good. A broken tooth, joyful. Loss of a job, joyful. Again, not that we feel that necessarily or that we enjoy it, but that we say, you know what? Maybe it's good that this has happened. Now, sometimes we actually get a kind of real-time understanding of this. You know, something bad happens and we immediately notice, oh, yeah, this actually had a really good result. Like when you wake up sick one morning and you can't go to class and then you find out everybody had a pop quiz today. You know, I guess it was good that I was sick after all. But the fact is, most of the time we don't have a real time, you know, what is God doing through this? So we have to choose beforehand to consider it joy. We may not know why it's happening or what it's going to produce, but we know that God brings trials for good. Now, James does tell us a couple of things about trials here. In fact, take note of these. These are in your notes. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kind. Notice that trials, first of all, are guaranteed. It says, count it all joy, my brothers, when, not if, not perchance if you should meet upon trials. He says, when you meet trials. This is a guarantee. And it's a guarantee, and not everybody's going to have the same trials, of course, but you will have trials, whether they're the big ones or the small ones. And frankly, both have a way of bringing out what's inside of us, don't they? Because sometimes I think when we think of the big problems, you know, we tend to have more of a stoic attitude, like, oh, well, this is a big problem. I guess I'm just going to have to trust God with this. But when it comes to the annoying little problems, sometimes we just get irritated. At least I find that's true with myself. Trials are guaranteed. First of all, they are without exception. Every person, doesn't matter who you are, is going to have trials. The rich, the poor, the powerful, the weak, the best, the worst. Everyone's going to have trouble, so it's without exception. Secondly, it's without warning. You notice he says, when you meet trials of various kind. I'm not a huge fan of this translation because it sounds like I'm going to meet a trial. I see the trial coming down the road, and I kind of wave at it, and eventually it gets there. But the word that's translated meet actually has the idea of falling into or falling upon. So it's more like I'm walking along and suddenly, whoop, I fall into a trial. I don't see it coming. In fact, this word that's translated meet here, fall into, is used two other times in the New Testament. Once is in Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan. Remember, there's a man from Judea who was going down the trail, and it says he fell among robbers. I can tell you this, he didn't see them coming. He was just walking along, and they jumped him. The other time it's used is in Acts 27, when Paul is on a ship headed for Rome, and it says the ship fell upon a sandbar. Again, nobody saw the sandbar before they hit it. It just came out of the blue. And that's how trials oftentimes are. You don't wake up thinking, oh, you know, what trials are waiting for me today? No, you just wake up living your life, and suddenly you're locked out of your car, and you're late for your appointment. And what else can go wrong? That's how trials are. They come without exception, without warning. They're guarantee. Second, trials not only are guaranteed, but they come in many shapes and sizes. You notice he says, when you meet trials of various kinds. This doesn't necessarily indicate that there's going to be a lot of trials, although that may be the case. The word various here actually comes from a Greek word which indicates multicolored. You think about, you know, Joseph in his so-called technicolor dream coat, right? Like, it's multicolored. So I think probably the best way to think of this is when you meet trials of all different spectrum. Expect the whole spectrum of trials, many colors. There are personal trials that you face. There are relational trials that you have when, you know, with family members or with people that you know. There are physical trials, maybe sickness or injury. There are many different kinds of trials, and they come at us in many shapes and sizes. Third, trials are an opportunity to grow. I want to take us to verse 3. We're not really to verse 3 yet, but notice the beginning. He says, "For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness." He calls trials the testing of your faith. So trials are an opportunity to grow. They're a testing ground for the faith that we have. The trials of life will probe whether we live what we believe. So they are opportunities, and that's why we should consider them joy. Not because they are enjoyable, but because they are opportunities for God to grow us. So this is our requirement, to count it all joy, my brothers, my sisters. So at this point, I want to make two things really plain. First of all, how we respond to trials shows where our heart is. And so when our gut reaction to a trial is to complain and to throw things across the room, it shows just how much self-control we lack. It shows that we believe that God owes us something. God, you owe it to me to have a great day, to have a pain-free life. God, you owe it to me to have ease and comfort. And then whenever something comes up that interrupts our ease and comfort, we think, oh, woe is me. Why, God, have you done this to me? Why have you brought this wickedness upon me? But see, we're starting from a false belief, and that exposes that. We're starting from this belief that, oh, God simply owes us sunshine and flowers. What if we had the opposite perspective? What if we saw the blessings as something we didn't deserve? I think this would be a profound change of mind for many of us. We tend to think, oh, God expects us, and we deserve from God this certain standard of comfort. But really, it's the opposite. God doesn't owe us anything, and what the many good things that we do receive are blessings, are grace from his hand. That might make us see life very differently. It might make us much more thankful people. So trials really expose what's already in us. Second, when we count it all joy, what we are doing is choosing to live our lives and to view our lives from God's perspective, not our own. So from our point of view, a leaky roof is a major inconvenience. So is a family crisis. But from God's point of view, it all has a purpose. Now, we may not know the ins and outs of that purpose, but by counting it all joy, what we're saying is, I don't necessarily understand this, God, but I know you have a plan in it. I know this is for my good. I'm going to count it joy. What, Lord, are you going to teach me through this? And I think cultivating that kind of thinking is important. We need to be those who count it all joy. I heard a story once, and I tried to track it down again. I heard it years ago, and I couldn't find it. So I'm just going off of memory. But I remember hearing the story of a woman who really tried to live this, who really tried to count every experience as joyful. And it was hard, but eventually she began to grow in that, and she began to think more along those lines. Well, one day she was at her SUV putting groceries in the trunk, and she lost her balance. And she fell on the asphalt, broke her hip. And I remember from her testimony, she was lying there. You know, people were running over to help. But as she was lying on the asphalt, looking up at the sky, she said, "Lord, thank you for this." Now, who of us would be lying on the ground with a broken hip saying, "Lord, thank you for this"? Well, if you've learned to count it all joy, then maybe you're viewing life from God's perspective, not your own. But it's interesting. He doesn't just leave us with this requirement. He also gives us the reason for it. The reason for why we should count it all joy. I mean, it'd be one thing if he just said, "Count it all joy. All right, I guess I have to, but I don't know why." Well, he gives us the reason. And the reason is simply this: endurance in faith. The reason we should rejoice in trials is because it gives us endurance. Now, the difficulties we face in life come from a variety of problems. We've already noted that. And I'm not going to pretend that the Bible gives us a detailed readout on every purpose, you know, everything that God is trying to accomplish through these. But James does shine the light on at least one primary reason for trials. Look at verse 3 and 4. It says, "For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." So he spends a little time here to explain that considering the joy of trials has a goal in mind. They're not just joyful for their own sake. It's because of what they produce. In verse 3, he talks about the pressure and the product. Let's begin by thinking about the pressure. He says, "For you know..." By the way, stop there for a minute. "You know." In other words, what James is about to tell them is not something that's some, you know, revelation from heaven. He says, you understand this. Like, this is, anybody who steps back and thinks about this for 5 seconds would come to this conclusion. You know this. He says, "You know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness." There's the pressure. The testing of your faith. That's a trial. Big or small, it's the testing of your faith. It proves the genuineness of the faith we claim. Sometimes I'm out at a store and I'll pay for something in cash and I'll hand a $20 bill and they'll pull out one of these counterfeit pins. Have you ever seen these? Where they'll take a pin and just like swipe it across your bill. I never really understood what that was or how it helped or how it worked. But it's actually a special pin that is meant to react to the particular makeup of paper money. And if you have a counterfeit, usually it's not of the same cloth material as the dollar bill. And so when they swipe this counterfeit pen across it, it'll light up. If it's gold, that means it's probably a real bill. At least I think that's what it was. And if it comes out as a dark mark, it's probably counterfeit. And I think of trials and the testing of our faith in that kind of way, that it proves whether it's genuine. So the trial is the marker slashing across our lives. And what shows up? What comes out in those trials? Is it the reality of our faith, or is it more complaining, more griping, more anger and confusion and frustration? So this pressure comes upon us. And the fact is, you and I need pressure in our lives. You may say, "Well, that doesn't sound very nice." It's not. It may not be. But without pressure, we don't grow. And that's why I say he says at the beginning, you know this. This is obvious to all, because not only is there pressure, there's also the product. He says, the testing of your faith does what? Produces steadfastness. This is an interesting word, steadfastness. It could be translated perseverance. It could be endurance. It has the idea of standing up under something, tolerating, persevering in some trial. Somebody once said this word refers to staying power. Staying power. And the only way you get endurance is through pressure, through testing. I mean, just think about it physically, right? I mean, for our bodies, for us to build stamina, it takes pressure. It takes some kind of exercise. It takes, hard work. I've been taking our son to the YMCA, or I guess the Y, for swim lessons. And right now it's on Saturday mornings. So we take him, I take him, he does his swim lessons. But sometimes while I'm there, the swim team is there practicing as well. And they'll have half the pool roped off and all these young people swimming back and forth and back and forth. And all I can think to myself is, better them than me. And it makes me a little bit tired watching them. But the whole point of the exercise, the back and forth, is to build their strength, to build their stamina. So when it comes time for the race, they're ready. And we can think about this with any number of athletics, right? I mean, why does anybody train in sports? It's to build stamina. It's to help them perform when it actually matters. And that's all James is saying. He's saying these trials build our stamina. They cause us to have this staying power. And that's a bit how we should think about trials. God is training us. It's endurance testing. He's building our steadfastness. You know, if our faith was never challenged and we didn't have these trials that came up in our lives, we would never progress. We would be flabby, unhealthy, immature Christians. Fact is, the best thing that can happen to us is trials, because it causes us to grow. Doesn't mean that they're fun or pleasant or that, oh, I love it when trials happen to me. But I know that they're good for me and they help me. I've read many different testimonies. I don't have any of them written down here, but many will tell you the best lessons I learned in life came not from the best of times. They came from the worst of times. I remember reading a quote from Malcolm Muggeridge. Muggeridge was a British intellectual who became a Christian later in life. And towards the end of his life, he said, of all the things I've learned, he said, of all the lessons I've learned in life, I have learned far more from my suffering than I ever did from the pleasures. The fact is, we need this testing if we're going to build endurance as believers. What's the result, though? The reason is that we might build endurance in faith, but the result of all of it is growth and maturity. Growth and maturity. You notice in verse 4, he says, and let steadfastness have its full effect, that it may be that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. So steadfastness is this quality which grows under pressure, and it has an effect. It's not the end result. It's part of the result, but it's not the end result. Endurance leads to maturity. Oh, by the way, if you want a parallel passage, I'm not going to turn there, but if you want to write it down in your notes, Romans chapter 5, verses 2 through 5. He talks about this very process, that endurance leads to growth and maturity. He says, let steadfastness have its full effect. The danger here, I think, is that we might short-circuit this process. Rather than growing in endurance, what do we do when trials come? Well, we gripe about them. And rather than learning to take trials as God intended, we sink into depression and anger and bitterness. We complain. We ask questions like, why me? Why now? Why this? So we don't accept them and we don't learn from them. We make ourselves worse. I think you probably have known people just like I have who, because of the misfortunes in life, become bitter and angry. Instead of growing into maturity, they become hardened and calloused. That's why he says, let steadfastness have its full effect. Let it go its course. Let it do its thing. I like how Simon J. Kistemaker, in his commentary on James, I like how he uses this illustration of a broken leg healing. You know, we think you break your leg, you get it in a cast, and it takes a while for that to heal up. Now, if you try and take the cast off early or you try and do something foolish, you might re-injure the leg. He says, but it takes time. It has to work its full effect. The healing has to work its full effect. So it is with steadfastness. You can't rush this process. Let steadfastness do its work in your life. Perseverance in suffering will help develop Christian maturity. So then he says, have its full effect that you may be perfect. Now we should note here, perfect doesn't, in this case, doesn't mean, and we know that as Christians, we don't reach perfection this side of heaven, like sinless, absolute, heavenly perfection. But what this term indicates is maturity. Let's get a little technical for a minute. So it's this Greek word teleos, complete, perfect. And really it has the idea of an end or a goal in mind. So when we think of perfect, like something is being perfected, that's the end goal to a process. Well, for people, the end goal of our process is maturity. Not necessarily, I mean, it will result in perfection when we finally are changed to be like Christ is, when we see him as he is. But on this side of eternity, we're growing. We're reaching maturity. You're perfect and complete. You could translate it this way, mature and whole. People that aren't immature and kind of trying to figure things out, we're growing towards more and more maturity, more and more stability, more and more steadfastness. Seeing trials as something that God sends for our good rather than something that interrupts our good life. And then he notes at the very end of the verse that we would be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. God has given us what we need to face trials. God has made sure that we are equipped. You may say, well, what if I'm still lacking something, though? Well, the next verse, and we're not going to be there this morning, we'll talk about it next Sunday, but the next verse says, if you lack wisdom, ask. So God's intention is that we would grow to the point where we're not lacking things, but if we do lack things on the road to that point, ask. God is gracious to provide. Here's a question I want to ask us. Can we do this? Can you and I really have joy in trials? Well, the answer is yes. Again, it's a bit of a mental shift to be able to say, I'm going to put these seemingly negative things on the positive side of the ledger. I'm going to view these trials as something good which God has brought to me so that I might be better. We can have joy and be joyful even in trials because we know that God's purposes and plans are bigger than us and they are for our good. One famous Bible teacher related this observation once. I thought this was helpful. He says, the most cheerful people I have met, with very few exceptions, have been those who have had the least sunshine and the most pain and suffering in their lives. The most grateful people I have met were not those who had traveled a pathway of roses all their lives, but those who were confined because of circumstances to their homes, often to their beds, and had learned to depend upon God as only such Christians know how to do. If that's the kind of maturity you want, if you want to be a person who is full of gladness and gratitude and cheerfulness, it only comes by growing in maturity, which only comes through steadfastness, which only comes through trials. So in kind of wrapping all these thoughts together today, I want to conclude with four items on a list here of how can we make the most of our trials? Trials are coming, they're guaranteed, they come in many shapes and sizes. How can we make the most of them? How can we put James 1, 2 to 4 into practice? Well, this is certainly not an exhaustive list, but it's a good starting point. Number one, welcome trials as a gift from God. Welcome them. Now, this doesn't mean, of course, being giddy when you smash your finger in the door or when you lose your job. But we ought to welcome these intrusions into our life because they have a profound effect on our Christian life and growth. I really appreciate how J.B. Phillips wrote a very famous paraphrase of the New Testament. It's quoted often. But listen to how he renders these verses in James 1:2. He says, "When all kinds of trials and temptations crowd into your lives, my brothers, don't resent them as intruders, but welcome them as friends." Welcome trials as a gift from God. Again, it's going to take you a bit of a shift in your mindset. And I've noted this week, even some of the things that have been happening. How can I think about this not as an awful, terrible thing, but as a gift from God? Number two, choose to focus on the purpose of trials. Instead of just being locked up on thinking about the inconvenience and the pain, we should focus on the purpose and what they accomplish. Yeah, I mean, we can choose to focus on how trials ruin my plans or interfere with everything that I want. But we can also choose to look at them in terms of what God is doing. We know that every trial that comes upon us is from the hand of God. It's working to make us more complete in Christ. It's teaching us the value of bearing up gladly for Jesus. Isn't it a wonderful thing that we can have faith that every trial, big and small, there's a reason, and that reason is to make us more like Christ? You ever think about this? How do people who aren't believers, who aren't followers of Jesus, do it? Because the conclusion must be, you know, all these, because they have all the same trials that you and I have. I mean, they have the same inconveniences and problems come up in their lives. But they have to conclude that, well, this is just bad luck. This is just terrible timing. There's no rhyme or reason for it. There's no purpose behind it. There's no God working things together for a good cause. But we have that truth, and we can cling to it. Our trials are not haphazard. They are not just bad luck. They're God's work in our lives. So choose to focus on the purpose. Instead of just saying, oh, this, I hate this. This is awful. Say, God, what are you doing through this? What are you trying to teach me? Number three, discipline yourself to count it all joy. Or another way I could say this is practice. Because the fact is, all of us need practice in this. I'm not somebody who does this perfectly or even well. My guess is you're probably not somebody who does it perfectly or even well either. So all of us need to practice. Practice counting it joyful. Here's the nice part. We're standing at the head of a new week. You got a whole, you know, 7 days before we meet together again on Sunday. And I'm going to guess, and I think I'm pretty good ground here, that you're going to have some trials come into your life. They may be real small. It may be something, you know, real minor. But you're going to have some things that come into your life this week that aren't that pleasant, that aren't that nice. I encourage you, even with the small things, try to consciously focus on saying, ah, this is bad, it feels bad. God, what are you doing through it? I choose to count this joyful. As we do that, as we practice this, as we become disciplined in counting it all joy, eventually it becomes reflexive to us. I was reading a passage from a book by R.T. Kendall, who was a preacher. And he tells of a godly old woman in the town where he grew up, a friend of his mother. And she once said this. She said, "I have served the Lord for so long now, I can hardly tell the difference between a blessing and a trial." I can hardly tell the difference between a blessing and a trial. It's like, I just realize everything comes from God. It's all for my good. Some of it hurts. Some of it feels great. But I can hardly tell the difference anymore. I just thank God for everything that comes. That only comes from practicing, disciplining yourself to count it all joy. And then lastly, and let me wrap it up with this, turn your trials into worship. Turn your trials into worship. When you read the opening of James 1:2, count it all joy, you know, I can't help but thinking of Paul and Silas under arrest in Philippi. You know, they were beaten pretty severely. They were locked in chains for something that really they should never have been locked up for to begin with. I mean, they must have been feeling pretty low. That must have felt like, wow, we're going through some trials right now, Silas, Paul. But what are they doing at midnight? Singing hymns. They're filling the prison with praise. See, that was a faith-testing trial, but what came through? Faith. Faith in glowing colors. They turn their trials into worship. How about the next time you're facing trials and difficulties in life? What if you turn that into worship and say, Lord, I don't know what you're doing, but I praise you. I thank you. Thank you for, you know, maybe you'd sing that song we sang today. Blessed be your name. Turn your trials into worship. I read a quote this week, and I'll close on this. It was from Fanny Crosby. You probably heard that name before. She was a hymn writer, but was also blind since she was a young girl. She was actually blinded in a botched procedure to try to help her eyes. So she could have grown up with a lot of bitterness and a lot of anger, but she didn't. She turned her trials into songs, quite literally. And someone once asked her about her condition, and she said, even if God gave me the opportunity for me to have my sight back, I wouldn't want it, because I've been able to see more of God with blinded eyes than with ones that could see. Oh, may our trials produce in us worship. May we count it all joy.